We believe that in order for repatriation to happen for the Rohingya, they need to be safe, dignified, and voluntary.
And he and others say none of that is taking place. This is Thursday, November 15th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You can be part of this program. To do that, join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, the U.S. Vice President attends an Asian meeting in Singapore with much talk about China. Harsh words against Muslims from an Australian politician. We take you there. And you'll take a trip to the northernmost city in the United States. All on today's VOA Asia. We start in South Asia, where Amnesty International is calling on Myanmar and Bangladesh to end their plans to send Rohingya Muslims back to Rakhine State, where the United Nations says they're subject to extrajudicial killings and other atrocities carried out by Myanmar's military. Joining us on VOA Asia is Francisco Benscomi, the Asia-Pacific manager at Amnesty International USA. Francisco, thanks for being with us. I take it that you were one of those expressing skepticism about the repatriation. Can you explain?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on your show. We actually express harder than just skepticism. We have strong concerns with the current plans underway to repatriate the Rohingya, which, according to both governments, will happen tomorrow. We believe that in order for repatriation to happen for the Rohingya, they need to be safe, dignified, and voluntary. And currently, the conditions on the ground do not meet any of those conditions.
Well, why is that? What are they telling you? Obviously, you have people on the ground there, as does the United Nations and many other NGOs. But nevertheless, these people are running scared. Why is that, and how are they doing that?
Absolutely. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that Amnesty International has documented a system of apartheid within Rakhine State, where the Rohingya who currently live there and have lived there for a long time do not have access to freedom of movement, do not have access to schools, to healthcare, and none of that system of apartheid, that system of discrimination has changed. All of those conditions still very much remain currently in place. Second is that we're extremely concerned because none of the Rohingya have actually been consulted throughout this process. Many of the names that have actually appeared on the so-called list for repatriation, some of the Rohingya have actually reported that they never knew nor were they consulted about any repatriation plans. So it's clearly, there's extremely concerns with whether there's voluntary and whether both governments are complicit in a form of forced repatriation.
What is the position of both the Bangladesh and the Myanmar governments on this issue? Do they want the Rohingya to return to Myanmar?
I mean, according to public statements that we've seen, they do want them to return. And under international law, the Rohingya do have a right to voluntarily return. Under, you know, it's their inalienable right to do so. And they're both countries are legally bound to facilitate returns. However, we don't believe that under the current circumstances, returns can be guaranteed as safe, voluntary, and dignified under international law.
As you have probably heard, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence had a meeting with the de facto leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, in Singapore at the ASEAN meeting and said this.
This is a tragedy that has touched the hearts of millions of Americans. The violence and persecution by military and vigilantes that resulted in driving 700,000 Rohingya to Bangladesh is without excuse. The arrest and jailing of two journalists last fall was deeply troubling to millions of Americans, and I look forward to speaking with you about the premium that we place on a free and independent press.
What was your reaction to that?
First of all, I think it was a very positive sign that Vice President Pence highlighted this to Aung San Suu Kyi. He called for accountability. He brought up the concerns about repatriation deal, and he also brought up the two Reuters journalists who continue to remain in prison in Myanmar. I think it's positive that the vice president brought it up. Second, I think it was extremely concerning how Aung San Suu Kyi completely dismissed his concerns and said, you know, something to the effect of, we know our country better than you do. I think the fact that, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi hasn't met with any of the Rohingya who were affected by this, the fact that she hasn't gone to either Cox's Bazar or to Northern Rakhine State to speak to many of those communities that were affected to this, you know, shows that, you know, there's a good chance she probably doesn't know what's actually going on in her own country. And it's partly why Amnesty International earlier this week decided to withdraw our highest honor, which is the Ambassador of Conscience Award, mainly because we've seen a lack of moral and political courage by Aung San Suu Kyi to speak out on behalf of the Rohingya and to speak out for human rights within her own country.
Francisco Benscomi of Amnesty International USA, thanks for being with us so much. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. The United Nations warned Wednesday that days of heavy fighting in parts of central eastern Afghanistan has worsened humanitarian conditions and urged warring parties to ensure safe passage for civilians attempting to leave the affected districts. At the ASEAN Regional Summit, Russian President Vladimir Putin and South Korean President Moon Jae-in discussed the ongoing peace process on the Korean Peninsula. A Cambodia court is expected to render verdicts Friday in the trial of the two senior surviving officials of the Khmer Rouge regime for crimes against humanity and genocide. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. We continue on VOA Asia. We told you that U.S. Vice President Mike Pence is the highest-ranking U.S. presence at the ASEAN summit in Singapore. Pence is touting what the Trump administration says is its commitment to keeping the Indo-Pacific region free and open. As White House correspondent Patsy Wodakuswara reports from Singapore, leaders are looking closely at what concrete offers Pence might bring to counter China's growing influence in the region.
Pence flew in from Tokyo, the first stop of his week-long tour, where he highlighted U.S. commitment to the region.
The Japan-U.S. alliance is historic. It is the cornerstone of peace and prosperity in the Indo-Pacific. And when the president directed me to represent him at the ASEAN and APEC conference, we knew that coming to Japan first was the right step.
Developing nations in Southeast Asia are hungry for infrastructure investments, and they are eager to hear what Pence will offer.
There's been the U.S.-Japan-Australia initiative on infrastructure. There's been a U.S.-Japan-India infrastructure on initiative, but not a lot of money coming into the region. What's been coming into the region has been obviously the BRI work in China.
BRI stands for Belt and Road Initiative, China's trillion-dollar investment strategy that has funded massive infrastructure projects in the region.
The One Belt, One Road Initiative is a fabulous idea. I just hate the fact that China came up with it. It's a compelling vision. Ultimately, the United States is going to need to come up with its own compelling vision, its own big offer.
The big offer, which Pence is expected to highlight in Singapore, is a new $60 billion agency to facilitate private investment for projects in the developing world. The American vice president will try to convince countries in the region that this is a better alternative to BRI, which he has criticized for offering loans that can put countries deeply in debt.
China is relatively new to developmental aid, to investment infrastructure projects, and also to working with other countries. So you can see some of the growing pains.
Sri Lanka, Maldives, and Malaysia are some of the countries feeling the effects of those growing pains and rethinking their loans from China. Beijing denies accusations of debt trap diplomacy, saying its readily available loans help countries desperate for infrastructure. To succeed, the United States will have to show that its investment alternative will be ready when needed, says analysts.
Clearly, a lot of these countries want to move as quickly as possible, and it remains to be seen, to your point, how quickly the U.S. can actually stand up and operationalize some of that investment.
Countries will also be watching what Pence will be signaling on trade, including on the U.S.-Sino tariff war, another big concern for a region that wants to avoid having to choose between two giants. From Singapore, Vice President Mike Pence travels to Papua New Guinea, where he will deliver a key speech at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation CEO Summit on the details of the Trump administration's Indo-Pacific strategy. Many countries in the region will be eager to hear what it's all about. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News in Singapore.
Happening now in Asia, a U.S. Congressional Advisory Committee says in a report released Wednesday that within the next 6 months, the U.S. Treasury should give Congress a list of Chinese financial companies and officials that could be sanctioned because of their ties to North Korean nuclear weapons programs. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you are with us. Australia's first female Muslim member of parliament has criticized the prime minister for suggesting that the greatest threat to the nation's way of life is radical, violent, extremist Islam. Scott Morrison's comments came after a knife-wielding Somali-born man was shot by police after a deadly attack in Melbourne on Friday. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Labour parliamentarian Anne Alley, a former international counter-terrorism expert, says Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison's comments on extremism were divisive. Morrison detailed the threat posed by what he called the radical and dangerous ideology of extremist Islam following an attack in Melbourne. Police believe Somalian-born migrant Hassan Khalif Shire Ali, who killed one man and injured two others in a knife attack, had links to Islamic State and had been radicalised. The Prime Minister has urged Islamic communities to ensure dangerous teachings and ideologies didn't spread in Australia. Anne Ali was born in Egypt and moved to Australia when she was 2 years old. Elected to Parliament in 2016, she's Australia's first female Muslim parliamentarian. She believes that politicians need to focus on giving Islamic communities the expertise and confidence to defuse extremism.
We need to move beyond words of condemnation. I think we need to move beyond these calls for the Muslim community, which every law enforcement agency that I've ever spoken to recognises is a very important ally in security, and move towards an effective prevention and intervention, early intervention mechanism.
Other Islamic leaders believe Friday's deadly attack in Melbourne was a result of failures by Australia's security agencies. The attacker, Shire Ali, previously had his Australian passport cancelled due to concerns he planned to travel to Syria in 2015. Despite being known to hold radical views, he wasn't actively monitored by intelligence agencies and wasn't deemed a threat. He was shot by the police during the attack and died later in the hospital. Meanwhile, a funding campaign has raised almost $85,000 to help a homeless man who tried to stop the attack by ramming him with a shopping trolley. Michael Rogers was filmed trying to stop Shire Ali from stabbing two police officers. The terrorism suspect had already killed a cafe owner and injured two other people. Australia's terror threat level remains at probable. There are 600,000 Muslims in Australia. Islam is the most prominent non-Christian religion in the country. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia, an Indonesian woman whose fiancé died on a Lion Air flight that plunged into the sea was photographed in her wedding dress and professed her love for him on the day they were to have been married last Sunday. Intan Siari's fiancé, Dr. Rio Nanda Pratama, was among 189 people who were killed when the Boeing 737 crashed October 29th, shortly after taking off from Jakarta. Visit VOA Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia.
We continue now with Asia business news. Global shares were mostly lower Wednesday after the steepest drop in oil prices in more than 3 weeks put investors in a selling mood. Japan's benchmark Nikkei 225 did inch up 0.2%, while Australia's S&P ASX 200 lost 1.7%. South Korea's Kospi edged down 0.2%. Hong Kong's Hang Seng fell 0.5%, while the Shanghai Composite was down nearly 0.9%. Shares were also lower in Thailand and Singapore. Factory output and investment in China edged up in October, but analysts said the improvement probably is temporary. Analysts say that's due to exporters rushing to fill U.S. orders before new tariff hikes take effect in January. Now on VOA Asia, everything about the city of Barrow, Alaska is special. The northernmost city in the U.S., it is home to indigenous carvers, fishermen, researchers, and teachers doing their best to preserve the native Inupiaq language. But at the center of the culture is a whale. It is its food, its symbol, and its soul. Natasha Muscovaya set off to Alaska to see what life is like in this frozen place. Anna Rice narrates her story.
The native Alaskan Inupiaq people who settled here thousands of years ago hunted the bowhead whales in the Arctic waters, and the harvest was shared with the entire community. Now, just like then, the whale is at the center of life and culture. The city's seal of Barrow, now known as Utqiagvik, proudly sports the magnificent animal. Its landscape includes palm trees made of baleen. One of the first things the children learn is how to help with whaling.
So that's why we take our kids out at a young age, you know. It's something you don't learn overnight. You just learn over the years. So, you know, I feel very confident that, you know, Lord willing, you know, we'll go on for another 1,000 years.
In Barrow, whales mean not just food. In a town with few attractions, they are at the center of the Nalukatak Festival, celebrating a successful whaling season. It begins with a solemn prayer. Then people enjoy traditional treats, from geese soup to whale meat and fat.
Getting our Eskimo food that we survive on. And hot soup on a cold day.
Nigalik soup or the geese soup or the eider duck soup, I could say. I love eating that. Especially the mikia, the fermented whale. I can't wait till they serve that.
Muktuk.
Yeah.
It's always muktuk. The homebrew he's talking about, it can be served at 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
Fermented walrus. Fermented whale.
Then comes the blanket toss. Hunters and others jump and do somersaults on a tightly pulled seal skin as they toss candy to kids. After 10 p.m., locals do traditional Eskimo dances and show their moves atop the same seal skin. Kids, elderly, and even whaling captains eventually join in under the midnight sun on this polar day. With all the fun, however, it's easy to forget how much hard work goes into preparing for the whaling season.
All year round, we're preparing for the whale hunt, and it's about feeding people, about feeding the community and making sure nobody goes hungry, and encouraging every able-bodied person to participate in the hunt, to keep your culture alive, keep your traditions alive.
That tradition is grueling and risky.
It's really dangerous. I mean, you're in a 20-foot boat, paddling up to a whale that's, you know, 30 to 60 feet big. So, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, little things that could go wrong. And it's just dangerous all the way around. Sleeping out on the sea ice, you know, I mean, there's a possibility of floating out, you know, with the ice. The current changes, the wind changes, you know, you get a crack, you know, I mean, it could happen so fast.
The U.S. government banned whale hunting for a time in the 1970s, saying their numbers had dwindled too much.
And so when the whaling was stopped, it affected family life. There was animosity. There was a lot of anxiety. The fate of our right to continue to hunt the bowhead whale was at stake.
Eventually, the government allowed some indigenous groups to resume the hunt, but with a strict quota. one the Inupiat say they respect to this day. So the ancient connection between the Inupiat and whales remains, as does the bare whale bone arch, a symbol of the sacred bond locals have with the ocean. For Natasha Mozgovaya in Barrow, Alaska, I'm Anna Rice, VOA News.
Conversion therapy and social exile for being gay is the subject of two award-winning independent films this season. The Happy Prince by Rupert Everett and Boy Erased by Joel Edgerton are based on real-life stories of gay men treated as pariahs by their communities. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with the filmmakers and the authors of the stories about the challenges gays and lesbians continue to face.
Oscar Wilde, the sentence of the court is that you be imprisoned and kept to hard labor for 2 years.
In 1897, literary giant Oscar Wilde has fallen from grace for his openly romantic homosexual relationship with Lord Alfred Douglas. After a 2-year prison sentence, he emerges a human wreck, impoverished and ostracized from society.
Not wearing your silk stockings today, Oscar.
You go too far, sir.
No, you go too far.
Rupert Everett, an openly gay director, scriptwriter and actor, directed and scripted the film and interprets Wilde. He says he wanted to show that in 19th century England, no man, not even a recognized figure such as Oscar Wilde, was impervious to social rejection for being homosexual. Rupert Everett says though the film harkens to a different era, it serves as a reminder that despite progress in the West, gays around the world still face discrimination and persecution.
It's a good reminder of what can happen, even in our countries, with the waves of populism that are kind of rolling over us. So I feel it really is a film for Trump's America, in a way, I hope.
Garrett Conley, a gay author who wrote the memoir-turned-movie Boy Erased about being forced to undergo gay conversion therapy after coming out to his conservative Baptist family in Arkansas, echoes Rupert Everett's warning.
This rather insidious idea that was implanted in us from, you know, basically birth, which is that to be openly LGBTQ meant that you were either a predator or you were going to be beaten or you were going to end up dying of AIDS. And those were the stories that we were told.
You want to say your goodbyes?
Welcome to the Refuge Program.
You cannot be born a homosexual. This is a lie. It's a choice.
Jared, God will not love you the way that you are.
Joel Edgerton plays a conversion therapist who uses pseudoscience, shaming, and torture to treat his patients. Edgerton directed the film and wrote the script. He says he made Boy Erased to bring to light the mistreatment and dehumanization young people encounter in these conversion programs.
I challenge people who are running these programs, and there are a large percentage of people who work as staff in these programs who identify as ex-gay or know in their core that the reason they're there is because they're trying to help repress their own sexuality, is to really tune in to the fact that is it really working for themselves? And why, if it's not inherently working for themselves, are they then trying to push these ideas onto other kids?
What you're going through right now is just a moment.
A moment.
Yeah.
A moment.
I love God and I love my son. For your father, it's a little more complicated.
We are not finished.
I am, because you won't listen.
Conley says his story is not about villains or heroes. It is about dismantling misconceptions and helping young gay people find their voice.
At the day's end, we get to choose how we love, when we love, what we do with our lives. And no one gets to tell you how to do that.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com and let's hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook and our email at voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, John Ellison, Mr. Ellison to all of us, managing editor Diane Gao, VOA of Asia team, Jim Stevenson, Skyler Ogden, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melbourne in Washington. Have a wonderful day.